Telemetry News Now.
Welcome to another episode of Telemetry News Now. This is, we're recording, I should say, on Tuesday, February 11th. And we have Valentine's Day coming up this Friday. So at least, I don't know, who celebrates Valentine's Day in the world? Is that just a U.S. holiday,
Justin? Oh, you know, I don't know. It's a good question. We may have to look that up.
Yeah, I guess so. Are you doing anything interesting?
No, special? I'm not very good about that, sadly. I'm usually traveling for once. I'm actually going to be home. So I guess I'm going to have to come up with something. Probably make dinner at home. Nothing too exciting.
There you go. There you go. We're actually going to my mother-in-law's house, who's doing something nice for all of us. And so I'm off the hook with dinner, but I am not off the hook with flowers and presents, which I'll, you know, purchase literally at like 11 o'clock at night on the 13th, because that's how I roll.
That's how guys do it, I think, at least most guys.
Yeah. I'm not very good with that stuff. So we got a busy week of headlines to get through. Lots of good stuff going on, lots of interesting stuff. So I'm going to kick it off this week with the headlines, diving into some news out of network world about Nokia. So Nokia announced just the other day that Pekka Lundmark will be stepping down as CEO. Now, he took up the position of CEO just about 5 years ago in 2020. And he's going to be replaced by Justin Hotard from Intel. Now, this is an interesting thing for me, at least, Justin, because Hotard is currently Intel's chief data center officer. And before that, he had some executive roles at HPE and NCR. And before I give you some of my thoughts here, here's a quote from Hotard. "I am honored to have the opportunity to lead Nokia, a global leader in connectivity with a unique technology heritage. Networks are the backbone that drives society and businesses and enables generational shifts in technology, such as the one we are currently experiencing in AI." So Lundmark is stepping down pretty soon, March 31st of this year, and is going to stay on as an advisor the rest of the year, which is pretty typical. And then, of course, Hotard will take over on April 1st of 2025. This is interesting to me because Nokia has some interesting platforms like their event-driven automation, EDA, and their line of data center switching, which, you know, a lot of people don't talk about very much. You know, I use SR Linux in Container Lab, so I'm familiar with the OS and the platform and some of those things. So I wonder if this is a step to really, really push to enter the enterprise data center market more than they have been in the past, especially because Nokia, I think, is known a lot more for more on the service provider side and some of their like network adjacent technology with like radio stuff and all that kind of thing, you know?
Well, I think it's interesting that he used the word AI right there at the end of his statement too, right? To your point, is it enterprise data centers, and specifically is it AI driven enterprise data centers, right? Distributed compute environments that they're wanting to get more into. Mm-hmm. We don't hear a lot about Nokia in those environments, but clearly they have products that would work in there presumably just as well as anybody else if you're going to build Ethernet in those environments instead of InfiniBand. So maybe that's part of the goal for Nokia and the board picking Justin as their next CEO here.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Right.
I was thinking as you were saying that it's a really small industry that he has a background at HP. We'll be talking about the whole HP Juniper thing here in a few minutes. So, you know, it's a very small industry we operate in.
It is. It is. And I do wonder about this because whether we talk about AI or anything else data center related, we're not necessarily talking about service provider technology anymore. I mean, you know, I get it. We're still routing and switching and moving packets. But when we get into the conversation about AI workloads and we get into the conversation about large data centers for large organizations, we are talking about more of that, you know, enterprise data center framework of technology. And so seeing him come over from Intel running their data center practice, at least as the chief data center officer, so I assume that's what he was running, that to me speaks as a potential new focus for Nokia moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so moving on, we have from the Cisco newsroom, a new study from Cisco is showing that there's a significant gap between CEOs' ambitions for AI, for AI adoption, and their actual preparedness to implement it. Now, I don't know if we needed a study to know that, you know, but I digress, right?
That's like the Captain Obvious article of the week there,
right? Yeah, right. But you know, getting back to the study, 97% of CEOs plan to integrate AI. And only 1.7%, less than 2%, feel fully prepared. That's an interesting one. What does it mean to be fully prepared? In any case, many of those CEOs fear that there are gaps in IT knowledge and infrastructure that could lead to competitive losses. So to me, this is really interesting because, you know, in the study, we're also learning that there are more than 70% of CEOs out there worrying about falling behind due to outdated technology. And then about half, 53%, believe that underinvestment is already costing them a competitive edge. And I'm presuming here that AI is a big chunk of that conversation now, although some of the language is a little bit more broad. Now, from the newsroom, Cisco's chief product officer, Jeetu Patel, emphasized that there is an urgency for AI adoption. And he warned that businesses have to act decisively or they're going to risk irrelevance. What's that old saying? If you don't like change, you're going to like being irrelevant even less, right? So that's kind of the idea there. Mm-hmm. And then according to Cisco, I mean, this really speaks to the importance of trusted partnerships. This is how they put it, right? So as 96% of CEOs are going to be then turning to external experts and consultants and presumably Cisco and other vendors to guide them through AI implementations and how to do that, how to look at that, even from a business perspective, I have to assume. But really, the study highlights that while AI does hold transformative potential, we already know that for driving efficiency, innovation, all that stuff, market leadership, there is an issue here with where companies are with actually implementing it, theory into practice. And companies have to overcome skill shortages, infrastructure challenges, right? Which is what we talk about a lot more on this podcast. And then there's the whole security risk component, which we're starting to talk about more and more. So an interesting study. And like we said, jokingly, I think, you know, is kind of like verifying what we already kind of suspected. But certainly something that is very top of mind for me lately, talking to different organizations about implementing AI, and they just don't know where to start.
Well, and I think that's what's really interesting is to see the data behind something that you and I have talked about a number of times, that there are some tangible use cases for AI, right? They're out there, but there's also a lot of AI washing and AI marketecture. And this study kind of backs it up with numbers, right? Most CEOs realize they need to be doing something, that they're going to get left behind. They're going to become irrelevant if they don't do something. But what is that something? The CEOs don't know. And if they don't know, I can almost guarantee the majority of their staff doesn't know, right? The other thing that I think is interesting, and this kind of passes the sniff test of some of the stuff you and I've talked about before, is like how much there is to learn and know about AI, the various different models. There's constantly companies coming out with new models. You know, that's just an LLM. So you go outside of that and some of the broader, you know, ML models. I mean, you could make it a full-time job to do nothing but learn and kind of staff up and skill up on all things AI and still feel like you're behind.
Yep.
I think I saw you and one other person on social media talking about how it's like becoming an entirely second job that you're doing just to try to keep up with what are all the latest buzzwords in AI. Nonetheless, what does all that stuff actually mean?
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, and that's a good point, because how does one in a leadership position who's already very busy mine through the buzzwords and understand what problems can AI solve? Is it just large language models? And I mean, the answer is no, but that's how everybody looks at it right now. Mm-hmm. But how do you navigate a lot of that stuff if you're already running, you know, an enterprise IT organization, right? At the C level or at the VP level, right? So how do you navigate that? How do you understand problems to solve? How do you understand the nature of data and whether you can solve those problems with AI, whether you should, or maybe there are simpler, cheaper solutions and you're just kind of going along with the crowd and with the buzz and with the feeling that you need to be using AI when you don't, for a lot of problems.
Well, and I think two things. One, that's where the consultants come in. Right? Mm-hmm. I think that's where there's going to be some consultants. Some are going to be good. Some are going to be less good. They're going to come in and be able to advise people on that.
Oh, sure.
And I also think that, like we've talked about on the podcast before, you got to really figure out what you're trying to solve for. AI as a technology is really powerful and can be really impactful. But if you don't know what you're going to do with it, what problems you have in your business that you're looking to solve, it's a solution in search of a problem. Right. And so I think starting with like, here's a few things that we think are very manual, very time consuming in our business that could be better automated with AI, to have some thesis and then be able to bring in a consultant that can help you figure out, well, is that actually feasible? And you know, what would it cost to solve that? How would it be solved, to kind of get down into the details? But as a, you know, as a CEO of a company, you're going to have to come up with the thesis on what it is you're trying to solve, or the consultant's not going to be able to help you.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're talking about a consultant, like a true consultant and not like professional services, what are you going to do then? Hire some ML engineers, data scientists. I mean, you need all of those folks. So, and then, you know, maybe software developers. I mean, I think the old saying, not the old saying, but the kind of the rule of thumb is you have two data engineers for every data scientist, you know, to work out the data pipelines and stuff to funnel it into your workflows. So there is certainly a skills gap. there's a just a staffing gap. And then, you know, we're talking about Cisco. So let's apply this to network operations. Do we have those kind of folks typically in a network operations environment? Not really. Mm-mm. You know, maybe a little bit now, but not really. So bridging that gap is going to be interesting. And how does a, you know, a VP of IT or a CIO, how do they do that? So really interesting study. Again, really something I've been already thinking about. And so when I saw that in the newsroom, I jumped on it right away. Moving on to more AI stuff, though, from Tom's Hardware. Remember that news about the Chinese AI startup DeepSeek a few weeks ago? It was kind of all over the news.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they got all that attention for its claims of training advanced AI models with minimal hardware, relatively speaking. Minimal hardware.
Even caused our markets to panic.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like $5 or $6 million, right? Now, to be specific, I do have in front of me some notes. The company stated that its model R1, it was trained on using 2048 GPUs and a budget of $6 million. And so, you know, yeah, what happened to the market? It led to a ton of speculation that DeepSeek found a way to dramatically reduce the cost of AI model training compared to like the big players like OpenAI. There was a challenge to this. SemiAnalysis, that's an organization, reported a challenge to this claim and revealed in their exploration that, surprise, DeepSeek's parent company, Highflyer, actually, that's the hedge fund company, actually invested around $1.6 billion in hardware with an entire fleet of 50,000 NVIDIA Hopper GPUs spread across multiple locations, specifically for the purpose of AI training. By the way, that's a normal thing for financial companies and, you know, these kind of organizations to do in crunching their data and do their financial modeling. Mm-hmm. The reality is that $6 million figure that they initially claimed, that only accounts for the GPU pre-training time, and it excludes all of the other expenses like research infrastructure, model refinement, all of that stuff. And then SemiAnalysis in their report also estimate that DeepSeek's total AI investments exceeded about $500 million since its launch as well. So this isn't to say, in my opinion, this doesn't mean like that DeepSeek's lean structure and strategic approach isn't still progress. You know, it's still progress.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that we can rule out that they perform some sort of AI miracle. That really shook up the market, shook up the world, and now we're starting to understand the truth here. But I do still see it as a positive. Their work is a result of massive investments. That's true, financial investments. But also, they have shown some cutting-edge research and a really highly skilled workforce.
Yeah. And I mean, I think part of the reason I pointed out on the last podcast, you got to take this with a bit of grain of salt, is, again, you got to be careful how much you trust of the media coming out, well, out of any country, but especially out of China, where it's state controlled and they're going to position things in a way that makes their country and their society look good. So, you know, now that more facts are coming out, we're seeing a little bit more of what the actual data is or how they position mm-hmm. the data to make them look good. But again, I still think there is some efficiency that hopefully other companies can learn from and we can get more efficient. I think, though, what this does show is that the demand for GPUs that you do this type of training and inference is still there. In fact, you know, with Stargate and the investment the U.S. is making in AI, and we'll get to an article about some additional investment in other countries, there's still a huge demand for GPUs, which is why the market panicked, by the way, right? Mm-hmm. The thought right. process was that if DeepSeek really is so efficient that they don't need these GPUs, the demand for the GPUs has peaked and we're now in a bubble and we're in a decline, and NVIDIA's valuation and anyone else who's doing building and designing custom silicon for GPUs is going to decline. And there's no evidence of that at this point, right? I mean,
yeah,
still plenty of demand out there for those for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that we're going to get more information as the days go on about specifically what DeepSeek and their parent company, or I don't know what to call them, their associated company, Highflyer, did to develop the R1 model. We'll see in time.
Yep. All right. Moving on. Europe has made moves towards their own AI future. I alluded to this a second ago, but French President Emmanuel Macron announced on Sunday that France has their own plans to invest 109 billion euros in AI in Europe to keep up with and compete with the United States. And Trump's recently announced Stargate plans that the United States will be doing. So, you know, here we have another country who is realizing, you know, kind of our conversation around the Cisco newsletter. We don't know exactly how investment in AI is going to help us out strategically as nations, but it's clear that there is something there, that that technology is important. Continuing to do the research, continuing to invest in it will be important for countries to continue to compete, in addition to companies and corporations being able to compete. You know, the other thing I thought was interesting about this, well, a couple things. This is not the European Union's investment. One headline I read made it sound like it was the European Commission that was doing this investment on behalf of the European Union. This is actually just France itself. So we may continue to see more announcements of more investment in other countries in Europe as well. And then the other thing is the timing is interesting. So Macron announced this investment just before France's AI Action Summit kicks off this week in Paris, where leaders and tech bosses from around the industry will be converging on Paris to try and talk about AI, but also how are we going to do AI safely? What are we going to do about security frameworks and putting some boundaries around building AI and making sure we do it in a safe and secure way as much as possible? So the timing of it is kind of interesting right before that summit kicks off. I'm sure that wasn't coincidence.
Yeah, I would say that this is 0% coincidence that you know, the timing is what it is. And that's how these things go, right? But it is interesting to me because in this whole AI discussion that we've been having for a couple of years now, and this new AI arms race, if you want to call it that, we've had American companies. So we have the United States, and now we've been talking about DeepSeek a lot, and it's been in the news recently. So we have China. Really is kind of the United States and China. And there are a lot of other countries out there with the means, the resources. I'm talking about like skilled engineering staff and people and academia and industry, the resources financially, and the incentive to want to compete in this AI arms race. Thinking about European countries first and foremost, of course. And here we're getting this news from France specifically. But that has been conspicuously missing up until now. It has really just been about the United States and China. So just to add a little bit of color here, we're talking about 109 billion euros, which is $112.5 billion in the French artificial intelligence sector. And what that means is, you know, 20 billion euros in investment from a Canadian company, Brookfield, or a Canadian investment firm, really, in AI projects in France, financing from the United Arab Emirates, which, you know, right now is probably around 50 billion euros in the coming years. This is not a one-time kind of a thing. This is a long-term plan here. You know, there's plans to finance gigawatt, multi-gigawatt data centers, starting with one in particular. And there's a French newspaper that reported that the bulk of Brookfield's investment would go toward a data center as well. So, you know, we're talking about publicly funded private enterprise and initiatives to do a lot of the stuff to, I think, kind of catch up with what the United States and China has been doing and then meet the future demand of AI in general anyway, right?
Yeah, and similar to the article when Stargate was announced by the United States, it's a little light on details on what exactly is that investment going to make in, right? Is it in the power grid and the infrastructure to power the data centers and the data centers themselves? Is it in the research and the software around the models themselves? Probably what we take away from that is it's a little of everything, right? You got to do all of the above. If it's an arms race and you want to keep up, you have to have the infrastructure underlying the model development, but you're also going to want to develop your own models and figure out a way to train the models for whatever use cases you see as a nation state needing to be able to do. That's the part I'm a little fuzzy, but I'm not in the public sector, so I'm not as clued in on what we have plans there as far as how to use it to protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, I'm still not convinced that anyone really knows where we're going with this whole thing anyway. I mean, I'm sure there's some folks in government that are leading the charge internally, you know, that are not out there in the press releases and in the news that have goals and plans. But certainly, I'm not convinced that anyone really understands how we're going to monetize artificial intelligence. So there's that. I mean, we have subscription models now. We have folks talking about generating ad revenue. And we also have this idea, I think, that, you know, now that we're talking about AI so much in popular culture and society at large, it's almost synonymous with large language model. Is that really what the investment here is in, to develop more GPT-like language models and Llama-like language models, you know, bigger scale, more accurate? Or is it really to support the research and development of, I guess, what you would consider more traditional? That's not the right word. The more traditional artificial intelligence, apart from large language models, the things that do very, very sophisticated and at scale data analysis and predictive analysis and perhaps, you know, with the advent of agents, actually perform a lot of the activities based on that analysis. So I think that's probably where we're going, but I don't think that anyone really knows how we're going to monetize it. I don't think anyone really knows exactly what's going on, but it's certainly something that everybody feels compelled to compete in right now.
Yeah, I was gonna make a comment about Elon Musk offering to buy OpenAI, but I couldn't figure out a way to do it without it being complete snark. So, yeah. All right, moving right along. The next article is from GeekWire talking about the Super Bowl ad that many people probably already saw if they watched the Super Bowl, which was T-Mobile launching their partnership with Starlink. We've talked on the podcast in the past about a couple of wireless carriers from other countries. I think I remember Telstra from Australia being one. There was one from Europe that I'm blanking on which mobile carrier that was doing something similar. And again, they're starting with being able to roam from T-Mobile's cellular towers to Starlink satellite for text messaging. So if you saw the ad during the Super Bowl, you saw the people not being able to get out a critical text message when they're out hiking in the woods and need to be able to contact their loved ones, either in the case of emergency or just to send them the cool picture from the top of the mountain. You know, the initial use case is around text messaging, but one has to think that, as you know, if this proves out and works well, that they'll expand it into voice and data and some other services that clearly you could bounce off of Starlink. I think what was interesting to me about the Super Bowl ad was at the very end where T-Mobile said for part of the beta, they're going to offer this up to AT&T and Verizon subscribers. The only thing I could take away from that is maybe if you're a AT&T subscriber, as an example, and you leverage this technology and you really enjoy it, when they close down the beta, it'll be enticing to switch over to T-Mobile.
Yeah, I mean, it's a limited number of spots that T-Mobile's making available for this beta test. And so if you get an opportunity to get in there, you get free text messaging. What are they doing? Also location sharing, 911 text services through June, I think. And that's only for those areas that they're describing as dead zones in the United States. After that, there is a commercial service that's going to launch this summer, and I think that's $15 a month if you're an existing T-Mobile customer, and $20 a month if you're with AT&T and Verizon. So it is interesting to me that T-Mobile is leading the charge. They're working with these other providers to push this forward, and essentially in conjunction with Starlink, right, introducing this satellite service without traditional cell service to just about anyone in the U.S. with a mobile phone. One of the things I think we forgot to mention is that your phone has to be 4 years old or less. It has to be younger than 4 years old for this to function.
All right, moving right along. The next article is from Juniper's newsroom. We did one earlier from Cisco's newsroom, so now it's time to pivot over to Juniper's newsroom. An update on the stalled Juniper and HP acquisition. Folks may have seen that in addition to being slow to, for the U.S. being slow to approve the HPE acquisition of Juniper, they've actually gone even further, and the DOJ has filed a lawsuit to block the acquisition. So Juniper now has a press release on their website speaking about their displeasure with that action and how they strongly oppose that, how both HPE and Juniper feel that the acquisition is good for both companies. I mean, I guess it's sort of obvious they would say that, or they wouldn't have entered into the agreement in the first place. But yeah, this is definitely starting to get more and more interesting. It's definitely starting to heat up a little bit. And the DOJ claims in their lawsuit that the biggest concern they have is about the wireless LAN market, and it basically brings it down to three primary players. If HPE and their Aruba product is now part of the same company and same portfolio as the Juniper Mist stuff.
Yeah, you know, I'm not 100% sure that's very accurate. I mean, there's going to be some consolidation. I get it. You know, we mentioned Aruba and HPE and Juniper Mist. Okay. But that still leaves a lot of players in the wireless market. You still have Cisco, which is a bigger player, right? You have Extreme, you have Ruckus, you have Huawei, you have Ubiquiti. There's probably some more that I can't think of right now. And I get it. Some of those are probably considered more SMB solutions, but whatever. There really isn't, though, this complete like wipeout of competition, which is the crux of the DOJ's argument to halt this deal, which makes me wonder if there's an ulterior motive that they want to use that as the mechanism to stop this deal, which, by the way, Justin, if you remember, you and I have talked about this in 14 other countries, including the EU and the UK. They've already approved this deal, leaving just the US holding, the US and Israel, excuse me, holding out. And if you go back and you read this article on the Juniper Newsroom website, it's actually from like 10 days ago or something, so maybe it's not as timely. They argue, Juniper and HPE, that the merger would actually boost competition and then fuel more innovation and strengthen U.S. networking infrastructure. You got to remember that HPE forms a huge foundation. It's like a big footprint in federal government infrastructure, right? And so they say that it would provide more secure tech and a big win for the United States and then by extension, America in general, right? So it's very interesting how there's this back and forth going on despite the DOJ's pushback. HPE and Juniper are very, very committed here, putting this out there to making this happen. And they're still pushing this in court. So we'll see where this goes, right?
Well, and the other thing to remember that's pointed out in Juniper's newsroom article here is that that's only a portion of their portfolio, right? I mean, they have all the service provider, Juniper has all the service provider products, the MX and the PTX. They have a lot of switching, data center switching. They have their whole security product line and the SRX. So there's a lot of things in their portfolio beyond just the wireless LAN, right? So, you know, yeah, sure, there might be some overlap between HPE Aruba Wireless and the Juniper Mist wireless, but there's a whole bunch of other products, some of which don't even overlap with anything in the HPE portfolio, right? So it's not, it's a little disingenuous to say that it's, if HPE were to acquire Juniper, that there's less competition in the market in a broader sense.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't believe that, you know, like based on what I said a couple of minutes ago, I don't necessarily buy that. I mean, is that just my cynicism coming through? I don't know.
I think there's some evidence behind that cynicism. I have the similar cynicism. You know, there was, I think I may have referenced it before on the podcast, but there was an SDX Central article that came out around the end of the year talking about how much of our United States three-letter agencies, things like the FBI and the CIA and NSA and TSA and all those agencies rely on some of the Juniper equipment. Like, you know, they have other vendors. I'm sure they have Cisco. I'm sure they have other vendors in their network, but they're pretty, you know, they're a pretty big customer of Juniper. And so it doesn't take a big conspiracy theorist to connect the dots to say, if the United States government allows HPE to acquire Juniper and Juniper end of life some of those products that those agencies rely on, there is a national security implication for the United States government, right? Because now they have to go in and figure out a replacement for those products that they were reliant on. So there is a potential that there's some angle to that. It has not really come out in anything that the DOJ has in their official lawsuit, at least not that I've read.
No, because that would be terrible to say out loud.
Yeah, right. Like, I'm protecting my own customer interest, not the interest of the, you know, the broader market.
And, you know, and to be fair, that's fine. That's the thing is that I'm not like opposed to anyone being in favor of their own best interests. I mean, isn't that what we all do? So, you know, the United States government as an entity doing that, fine. Juniper and HPE doing that, that's fine as well. But for me personally, understanding how all of this plays out so we as an industry, a networking industry, can make the best informed decisions, that's what I really care about here.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine who, by the way, I worked at Juniper for 10 years, if folks listening didn't know that. And so I still have some friends over there. And I was talking to one of them here recently, and they were saying they kind of don't care, right? And what I mean is not that they're not paying attention to the situation. They obviously are, but it's business as usual, right? Both companies are still going out. They're still selling their products. They're still supporting them. They're still trying to do what's right by their customers until this is all worked out in the legal system, right?
Yep. Well, according to the Juniper Newsroom, HP and Juniper plan to vigorously defend this transaction in court. So I'm sure we'll see more more news in the headlines coming up soon.
People get to hear us talk about this more. Yeah. All right. One more quick mention before we get into the events here. Folks probably noticed that there was a PlayStation outage recently. And so Tom's Guide had a quick article about the PlayStation outage that took place on Friday, February 7th that evening, and was down for nearly 24 hours. Sony and the PlayStation Network claim it was a scheduled maintenance that caused it, although it's a little bit curious to me that you'd have a planned maintenance that would last for 24 hours. So it seems like it must have been a one of those maintenance windows that went horribly wrong that anyone who's ever operated a network is probably familiar with, but there's just not a lot of details here. So,
or it wasn't a maintenance window.
Or it wasn't a maintenance window. Yeah.
We just don't know, but that's a very significant outage from them. And not much details coming out from Sony yet about that. So we'll see. Okay. And now moving on, last but not least, we have upcoming events. On February 19 and 20, so just about a week and a half away, we have Cloud Field Day. That's an event put on by the Tech Field Day Group. On February 20 in Hartford, Connecticut, we have the Connecticut NUG. On March 5th in Tampa, Florida, we have the Florida NUG. And if you're not familiar, the networking user groups, or the NUGs as we like to call them, are events put on by the USNUA. If you're interested in finding out more about that and seeing if there's an event near you, you can go to usnua.com and check the events page there. On March 7th, we have DevOps Days Los Angeles, in Los Angeles, California, obviously. The Indiana NUG on March 13th in Indianapolis. DevOps Days Chicago on March 18th. One of the bigger ones for me personally, Networking Field Day 37, March 19 and 20. Make sure you catch the live stream of that on LinkedIn, their website, I think some other places as well. And last but not least, on this list at least, we have Data Center Connect, March 24 and 25 in New York City. I will almost certainly be at that one and possibly one or two of the other ones.
Yep. One final plug I'll put in for those USNUA events. If you go out and find your local one, you can attend because the date and time just doesn't work for you. Still sign up for their mailing alias and they'll send you updates for future events. So you'll be able to make a future one, even if the next one is not going to work out for you.
Great. Good idea. Thanks, Justin. So with that, those are the headlines for today. Bye-bye.